Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisquintas.
We talk about food on this show. For some of us, that means a trip to the grocery store, a restaurant, maybe pizza delivery, or some folks, I hear, even get some real fancy things FedEx to them via some gourmet restaurants. Or maybe you go to your own garden. For some of us, food comes by way of connection with a farmer, at a farmer's market or through a CSA. But all food comes from the earth. It's still out there, a lot of it growing without any tending by us. Wild game, fruit, mushrooms, there are still those that know how to hunt and gather. Today we welcome Adam Wilkie to our kitchen table. Adam is a PhD in
student
in the Department of Sociology and in the graduate program in sustainable agriculture at Iowa State University. A few weeks ago, Donna was saying, I haven't had wild rabbit in a long time.
Or any kind of rabbit.
Yeah, rabbit.
Even a tame rabbit.
We're talking about it. And she said, does anyone hunt around here? Do you know anyone that hunts? And I said, yes. So welcome, Adam.
Hi.
There you are. There you are. So I guess I met you at potlucks, and you always bring wonderful things, of course. Because not
rabbits, maybe.
Rabbits. Not only all kinds of game, but you know how to gather things in the woods. How long have you been hunting and gathering?
Well, for as long as I can remember, I guess. I was just sort of...
It just comes to him naturally, I believe.
Yeah. Normal thing we did growing up on the weekend. We would go hunting.
Adam's from southern Minnesota. I already asked him. So that means it's a skill you learned from your, well, did your mother hunt too, or is this just in the male lineage? Your grandfather, your father, who hunts in your family?
I guess it was mostly a male thing.
It's a guy thing.
Yeah. Going with my father and grandfather.
That's what it was in my family, only that's why I don't know how to hunt.
Well, it was in my family, too, but I always went along, so I learned.
Oh, good for you.
One of those skills. So what's in the woods now, Adam?
Edible, that is.
Edible. Yeah, what have you been finding?
Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Oh,
some of that.
Well, there's a lot of edible things in the woods right now. Recently, hunting season's just opened, so there's quite a few animals that people could pursue in the woods for food. Also, there's a lot of mushrooms. As the residents of Ames and Story County know, we've had a plethora of rain this season.
Oh, yes. Very wet season.
And I didn't even know that there were mushrooms in the fall. I am a morel person in the spring, so I am aware of that. Adam, you have a whole bunch of stuff here, and they all look all funny shape, but you do assure me they are mushrooms. Talk about what you found in the woods recently.
Yeah, there actually are quite a few different varieties of mushrooms that will fruit in the fall, pending if the conditions are right. So here I just brought a few of them just to show some different shapes and colors and smells.
We'll hold them up to the microphone, don't you?
Right. I told him to bring something edible because we like to smack our lips in the microphone.
And the listeners can visualize.
So what is that fluffy-looking thing?
So one of my favorites, it's called the hen of the woods or the maitake mushroom.
A maitake is called a hen of the woods. Okay.
Yep. I believe it originated in Japan, and I just read recently the word maitake means dancing mushroom because historically whenever one was found, people would dance because back then these mushrooms were actually worth their weight in gold.
They have some medicinal qualities. Oh. I'm not sure what they are, but they're rather famous for that. But I didn't know it was called hen of the woods.
Yep.
Do you know what it's prized for?
Yeah, so they're actually doing a lot of academic research now to figure out the specific compounds it's said to have. Mm-hmm. A lot of different beneficial healing properties. People are experimenting with it to mitigate against cancer, among other things.
It's soft.
It's really interesting to think how in ancient cultures these resources were very prized and utilized by people, and now we're sort of rediscovering in a different manner, you know, scientifically how their values are actually important to our health.
Well, and it's beautiful. This is is this an average-sized specimen?
No, that one's actually pretty small. Like,
this is small. Oh, my goodness. It's a good 6 inches across.
It looks like sort of a golden brownish, grayish, very loose head of cauliflower.
Yeah, it does. Except, like kind of flattened instead of rounded.
Multiple little mushroomy lobies coming out of it.
Oh, and it's soft, although it looks like it should feel woody. It's really beautiful.
Where does one find – does this grow on a log or on a rock or on a – where would one find this sort of thing?
In the ground, on the tree.
So hen in the woods will always grow at the base of an oak tree. Whether alive or dead. And usually where you find them, they'll come back again the next year.
Oh,
that means you have your spots, right?
Yeah, something like
that. Wow. Well, this one is obvious enough. And if this is a small specimen, they must not be that hard to find.
Yeah, so I've seen pictures of them recently because it's been a really big year across the season from Minnesota to Missouri.
Imagine.
You can go look online and see pictures of maitake mushrooms as big as a kitchen dining table. They get upwards of 40 pounds. And the trick is to pick them at the right time when they're fresh before the bugs have gotten to them because they do get dirty over time. And the key is...
When do the bugs come?
Well, bugs and critters like squirrels and chipmunks really love mushrooms too, so you got to beat them to them.
So this has been growing all summer? How long does it take to grow like this 6-inch variety?
Oh, no, they grow very quickly. So you'll find them that'll have plants, leaves, sticks, you know, grown through. They can essentially grow overnight. But they do take longer than, say, a morel. So I would say that specimen, almost volleyball size, is maybe a week or two old.
One is only a week or two old.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And unlike other plants, mushrooms and fungus propagate themselves not by seeds. So do they come back from the roots every year, or do they have roots? I don't even know what they – you said they come back usually in the same place. Why?
Yeah. And that's something I guess science doesn't understand completely. Mushrooms are a very unique biotic community, and their reproduction is somewhat of a mystery. Like some listeners might know that the morel mushroom, you can't propagate commercially, whereas the hen of the woods, the maitake, people do propagate it commercially.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah, you can actually buy it as an herbal supplement.
Yep, that's true. A lot of people use that for health purposes. But you can go online and buy the spawn of it, and you can inoculate logs or different substrates and grow it yourself. But it's never as good.
So you find this growing.
Yeah.
And you just clip it off with a little knife or something?
Yeah, basically in the field, what you ideally want to do if you have time and it's not getting dark, you want to try to trim off as much of the dirt as possible in the field. So you try to not want to bring that stuff into your kitchen. But
are you supposed to leave some behind or not? Or you just take the whole thing?
Well, that's kind of a myth too as well. With hen of the woods, I don't think it's as important because they sort of have that rhizomatic connection with the oak tree, whereas the morels, people always say to use a spore bag and make sure the spores can drop over the place. So it kind of depends on...
You're going to have to say what a spore bag is. Uninitiated folks.
Okay. So, you know, people have different traditions and mythologies of mushroom hunting, but a lot of people will go out with... Think of like a laundry mesh bag or maybe an onion bag. So the thought of that is when you pick the mushrooms, its reproductive defense is to quickly drop spores, which are the equivalent of seeds. So it's trying to reproduce itself. So from your...
Is this something so small you can't really see it?
Yeah. It's microscopic.
So it's like a little magical fairy dust is falling off while you're picking it, right?
Yeah.
Well put when you're talking about mushrooms.
Uh-huh.
That's right. And so, maitake, that's maitake, maitake.
Yep. Yeah,
so you put them in the spore bag.
Yeah, and so the thought is from the spot you pick it to the time you get out of the woods, the specimen has dropped its spores all over the place. So then you're sort
of... So you're like walking out of the woods holding up the spore bag so it drops its spores along the way like Hansel and Gretel or something?
Yeah.
Cool. I got to get myself a spore bag. I like this.
Now, I've heard of that this is called hen of the woods. I'm familiar with one with a more orangish sort of thing called, you said it was a chicken of the woods?
Yes.
Some poultry of the woods, yes.
So another very delicious mushroom and also very easily to identify is called a chicken of the woods mushroom, also known as sulfur shelf, and that does have more of an orangish,
sulfur
yellowish.
Shelf?
Yeah.
S-H-E-L-F?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
I like the language around all of this.
Yeah, the thing about mushrooms is you know, each different region, you know, if you go out east or go to Michigan, say, they might call it something different. So it's funny reading about mushrooms online. People, you know, will have five or six different names for these mushrooms. So a lot of the people who are trying to be experts will go with the Latin name. But I think it's kind of fun to list off a couple names. But the chicken of the woods and the hen of the woods, it sounds so appetizing. And when you can eat it and consume it, it does have the texture and almost the taste of a meat. And
it tastes like chicken.
Mushrooms have an incredible amount of protein and are very equivalent in feeding the, or excuse me, having the nutrient compounds that, that meat actually
would.
And aren't
they
actually, it's a great substitute.
Usually high in B vitamins too and other. All right, so this thing has a lot of soil attached to it, this maitake.
Yeah, so that.
So how do you clean them? Is it true you're not supposed to wash mushrooms, that you're supposed to brush them?
Yeah, people do say that, and I would agree, because when you cook it, it really influences the texture.
Yeah, they do. Even a common commercial mushroom will just suck that water right up and not be – it'll get soggy when you cook it.
Yeah.
So the same thing is true. So how are you going to clean this beautiful specimen?
Well, usually what I do, you do take a little brush and take a little knife and try to get as much dirt off as you can first, and then sort of cut it up into small pieces, not serving size pieces yet, but smaller pieces. And then with the maitake, I'll actually parboil it a little bit to sort of get a change of water through it.
Oh, so you do have to get it wet.
Because my task today has been trying to make maitake jerky. So parboiling it, and then I'm going to marinate it in maple syrup and apple cider and then dehydrate it and see how that turns out.
So I bet you use, like a live apple cider.
Yep.
What a good idea.
And then you dehydrate it in a dehydrator?
Yep.
Oh, wow. And then it has a long shelf life, right?
Yep.
Okay, now if you wanted to just flat out eat this right away, or like if I take off a tiny piece, and can I eat it?
You can try a tiny, tiny bit. People don't usually recommend consuming wild mushrooms raw, but that is...
Because?
Well, there's different compounds in them, and different individual stomachs will react differently, so you just want to know yourself. But that is one indicator.
It's gritty. And it tastes mushroomy.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a field test also for identification. Mm-hmm. You don't want to eat too much, but you can put a little bit in your mouth and, you know, see how it tastes, spit it out if you need
to. Dangerous ones have any bitter flavor? Can you tell if you were eating a nasty one and spit it out, or you just...
Actually, yeah, that's the interesting thing about mushrooms, is the ones that are edible do smell and taste really, really delicious. And the ones that are not edible have sort of an off or unpalatable, almost bitter flavor.
Oh, the kindness
flavor
of Mother Nature for
that's
us
a good start.
Ignorant humans.
That's a good start.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
What other kind of mushrooms did you bring? You got a whole little...
Oh, so I also brought some honey mushrooms.
Aren't those pretty?
Yeah, these are...
They're small little brown. This one looks like the classic fairy book children's kind of mushroom with a jaunty little top.
Yeah.
This is a honey mushroom. Never even heard that term. Is this also a honey mushroom? These are the babies?
Yeah, they're really pretty, and they'll grow in clusters at the base of mostly a dead tree.
Any kind of dead tree.
Yeah, that one's not specific to a tree species. So I think those spores are more widely dispersed.
And does this have other names in other places?
Well, I've heard about the honey mushroom. It's also called armillaria.
Armillaria.
I think is the Latin
name.
Well,
that just rolls right off your tongue,
doesn't
it?
I must admit, I'm not much of an expert on the scientific side of things. I just like to find them and eat them. But I've actually never seen... in my life, such an abundant fruiting as right now. You can basically go in any woods in Ames and find honey mushrooms, and they're really pretty, you know, just to take a picture of or to smell. I like to dry them to use them to thicken soups in the wintertime.
So will you dry this straight out, or will you put it in the, what was it, apple cider, not apple cider vinegar, apple cider and honey?
Maple syrup.
Maple syrup.
Yeah. No, that was just something I'm trying as an experiment to make maitake jerky. But if I was going to, say, dry the honey mushrooms for winter use, I'd probably just dry them straight up and powder them.
Just so you brush them off. Do you slice them up and put them in the dehydrator?
Yeah.
And then you pound them into a powder.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, and a food.
Which is actually in a culinary way. Like, I've used a lot of porcini like that. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to have a stash of powdered mushroom because you'll put it in a broth of any sort in the winter. And with porcini, you get just this rich, rich mm-hmm. stock. And since it's powder, it's kind of like, oh, what is this? Because you don't see the mushroom. You don't feel it. It's just like the umami of flavor, as mm-hmm. it were.
Yeah. You have another one in your box there. What's that one?
Oh, yeah. So the last one I brought, it's called an elm oyster. They used to think scientifically it was related to the traditional oyster mushroom, but now I think it's in its own Latin name category. And that'll grow on a lot of different kinds of trees. I'll find them on box elder trees. Mm-hmm. And they grow sort of up the tree the whole way. So it's funny, I've seen pictures of people.
In stair step kind of things?
Yeah, sort of. So people actually like tape a knife to the end of a broom or something to go out to harvest them.
Isn't that lovely?
So that's kind of neat. And that's one that does have a little bit of a tougher texture, so
yeah,
might be better.
So is this more, this is how they're growing, or is this one a little bit older than these?
That one's older. It's been dried out more. That was picked last week.
You can mm-hmm. smell this one.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Now, this one is called the elm mushroom, and it has a stem. Is that the proper term, the stem?
Yeah.
Okay. It has a stem. And you said it's sort of like an oyster mushroom. Mm-hmm. An oyster mushroom does not have a stem.
Yeah.
Or it has one so little you wouldn't notice it.
Yep.
That an oyster mushroom grows on the side of trees. It looks like a shelf. I do sort of recognize that, although I can't say that I've harvested huge bunches of them, but that one I have.
So this is growing out sort of perpendicular from the tree like this?
Yep.
Wow.
Wonderful stuff. And just think, it's out there. So do you have a route that you checked every now and then for your mushroom?
He's not going to tell us.
Well,
I bet you.
Don't tell me where, but I know timing is important.
Oh, absolutely.
So visiting places again and again is probably helpful.
Yeah. Well, also the internet helps a lot. Seeing specifically rainfall precipitation totals.
Oh.
So you can get very location-specific rainfall totals and sort of migrate to where it's been raining, follow the rain. And also there's a lot of social media. People post their different finds, so it sort of gives you extra incentive to go look. But surprisingly, around Ames, there is a lot of public land. I think people have this conception of Iowa, there's not much, but the Skunk River.
Oh, we have lots of parks.
Yeah, so the Skunk River Greenbelt, or you know, any of the parks in town, mm-hmm. Carr Woods or Munn Woods, great mushroom hunting locations.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, you know, have fears of bugs and itchy weeds, so they stay on the trails. So if you go off the trails even a little bit, you're bound to find some mushrooms.
Yeah. Here's a nod and a good thing to say about the commons. We still do have the commons, and to realize that food is growing out there, nature's doing her job, there's things to harvest, and keep your eyes open. This is good. You've got something kind of swimming around in a jar over there. My goodness. What is that?
That's just tea.
Right.
I figured maybe it was made out of some sort of mushroom or other. Also,
he brought a cast iron pan, too, so we're going to have to talk about what's in the pan.
Oh, so what have you been – what's been on your plate recently? What is in your cast iron pan over there?
So I brought a little bit of food to share. As winter time's coming, I get into eating much more heartier foods, so a lot of meats and mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
So in the cast iron, I have – venison and hen of the woods mushroom with onions
Ooh.
And garlic,
Ooh.
A little bit of butter.
That sounds wonderful. You mentioned that you hunt deer. You bow hunt.
Yes.
And that you do around Ames too, or do you go back to Minnesota for that?
I go around Ames.
Okay.
Yeah, we have plenty of spare deer here.
Yeah.
So you said hunting is open. What can be hunted right now besides deer?
Besides deer, you can hunt rabbits, squirrels, I think geese and duck. I haven't bird hunted in Iowa. Can't think of any more.
No other ground critters.
Possibly.
Hmm. Well, we have enough deer and rabbit
rabbits
to content any hunter.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll take a bit of a music break here. Here's a waltz. Start thinking about mushrooms.
The hunter's waltz. The mushroom waltz. Something like that.
Thank you. Welcome back. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI Radio, Radio 89.1. We're community radio for the heart of Iowa. Today we're talking to Adam Wilkie about wild edibles. He's got a wonderful connection with what grows.
And boy, are we having it. We couldn't even stop the conversation during the music. We're so curious.
During the conversation, you mentioned a wonderful fact about mushrooms, Adam. Tell us about mushrooms.
Oh, yeah. Well, we were just talking about the mysteries and myths of mushrooms. And one of the things I think is really interesting about them is that in a lot of ways they're actually more closely related to humans than they are plants, which a lot of people don't think about. But whereas plants take up carbon dioxide and breathe out oxygen, humans take in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. And that's what mushrooms do. They actually breathe in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. So it's just a really neat biotic community that I don't think science really understands enough completely. You know, we sort of read about these things, bioremediation and these different types of techniques of applying mycology to, you know, natural resource cycles and food production.
Oh, bioremediation. That's a whole nother. We're going to have a show on that. You can tell. Wait, it's exciting stuff.
Yeah,
and mushrooms have been doing it all along.
Yeah. Naturally. Like, I'm petting this little maitake, and it feels so like skin, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so plump and fleshy.
Now don't go off on no tangent here.
Oh, boy. Okay. Mm.
Good.
Mushroom love. Okay.
Oh, we got you here to talk about rabbits, Adam. So tell me about finding rabbits around here, how you gather them, and how do you cook the little devils when you finally have them?
Okay. So I think the rabbit season opens August 30th, and it goes all the way till February 28th. So usually I think a technique a lot of rabbit hunters use is wait until it snows, because then the food sources of the rabbits become much less, and you're able to predict much more where they're actually going to be located.
And you follow their tracks.
Yeah. So a lot of traditionally farmers are sort of have brush piles, you know, which are informal wild rabbit houses. And so you sort of know where they're located. But so when you're out in the woods, you're looking essentially for big piles of sticks, other places where rabbits would like to habitate, and then also what they're eating. So after it snows, they really enjoy eating, fresh growth bark, little trees.
Oh, yes,
stuff
they do
like
that. They like little trees.
It's a lot of landscape damage.
Yeah, so if you have landscaping in your yard, you probably have a good idea of what rabbits like. And interestingly, around Ames, there's a lot of rabbits.
Is this an unusually heavy rabbit year?
I think so. Oh. And I had heard that mentioned. It sort of goes in cycles like a lot of different animals do. And I think the rabbits, for whatever reason, have just had a great year.
I guess they like the rain, too.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. Well, they like to graze on clover and stuff.
Yeah, it gives them a lot of food.
Yeah. So, once you find one, do you hunt with a dog?
No. And that's a lot of the reason in Iowa I don't hunt as much as I used to in Minnesota, because when rabbit hunting, they're very fast and they hide beneath things, and you really don't want to try to harvest an animal that you're not going to be able to find. So, yeah, it is a good idea sometimes to have a dog just for the sake of the recovery of the animal, but it's not completely necessary.
Yeah, that's good.
And do you trap at all?
No, I don't personally. I have some friends who do, but that's something I've never really gotten into.
Oh, my dad was big on rabbit trapping, and he taught all the grandkids how to make a rabbit trap. Even his great-grandson, he built rabbit traps for all of them, and it was like the joke in the family. Because when he grew up in Western Illinois, and when he was a boy, he did a lot of trapping and collected pelts. Mm-hmm. And I think he told me he got a nickel a pelt and sold them into the market in Chicago. So that was a big childhood. I'm sure they hunted them, too, but And I'm sure they ate them.
Yeah. So what does one do with a rabbit when gets it into the kitchen?
Well, there's a lot of different things to do with a rabbit. Like game meat, a lot of people say it has a stronger flavor than you would expect from, you know, your traditional supermarket meat.
It actually has a real flavor.
Yeah, I was just going to follow up with saying
that.
I love
wild rabbit.
So it actually tastes really, really, really good and
very
has a
rich.
Lot of flavor. Very rich.
Especially in a season like this where they've had incredible grasses. I mean, I bet the rabbits this winter are going to be fabulous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so cooking a rabbit depends a lot on your audience, who you're serving it to, who's going to be consuming it. Because if you're serving it to people who maybe aren't familiar with wild game or maybe skeptical of the stronger flavors, there's a lot of different, you know, creams and red wines and things you can use in the stock to prepare the rabbit. But there's a lot of ways where you can, you know, simply fry it, salt it, bake it, those types of things, and you really get those flavors. So first, sort of consider who you're cooking for. And then second, I think the fat in the rabbit, the stock that you get, is one of the best things. And so, you know, my favorite traditional way to cook a rabbit is just put it in a crock pot with a ton of onions and garlic and maybe apples and stuff like that and just cook it for a really long time. And then that liquid, that stock, that's one of the best things to have in
soups. Oh, yeah, you're
going to
get a lot of minerals from the
all
bones
winter.
And stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So usually I'll just cook it in a crock pot for a couple of days and then bone it out.
A couple of days? Wow.
Yeah, usually I'll put something on low overnight
Let
it cook through the next day, and then maybe I'll pick off the bone and then maybe use that meat for, like, tacos or something.
Oh, and then throw the bones back in and keep cooking.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then cook it another night, and then I'll strain that stock and then have that for any other kinds of soup. So it's great to have rabbit stock on hand throughout the winter.
Oh, I do that with chickens, but rabbits, oh, how fabulous. Mm-hmm. Now, game meats tend to be a little leaner than, you know, than a farm-raised animal. And in France, it's very traditional to cook bacon with your rabbit. Mm-hmm. Adds that extra fat. They'll kind of wrap it in bacon and give it a long sauté.
Yeah.
Or steam.
How much meat is on a rabbit? Is a rabbit half a rabbit person or does... I don't know how big a rabbit is once you get all the fuzzy bits off.
Well, that's a good question because I think rabbits do look a lot bigger than they actually are because they have a lot of fur to keep themselves warm. So when you harvest a rabbit and you skin it, you might get a little less meat than you expect, but that's why I think the crock pot method and other ways of slow cooking it where you can really get all those little tiny bits of meat off the bone are important. But full-sized, a mature rabbit, you could say a rabbit per 2 to 3, maybe 4 people, depending on what you're serving it with.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. That's
what do
good.
You do with the pelts?
Well, ideally, you would tan them and hide them and keep them.
and line your baby buntings with them.
Yeah. Yeah, we could bring them to Chicago and sell them on the market. It doesn't really work like that anymore, but tanning them is a whole different process that you could probably commit another show to, so I am not as experienced in that as I'd like to be. But
Well, good. You're going to be teaching a course at ISU next semester. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I have fortunate to have the opportunity to have some mentors that are helping me propose and teach a course in the Natural Resource Ecology Management Department. It's going to be listed as NREM 305, a one-credit course on wild edibles. So we're going to be talking about the social, cultural, and historical context of what is wilderness and what is food, and then also hopefully be doing some field trips and field exploration to identify and collecting different wild edibles that are in Iowa in the springtime.
Exciting. And when will you be teaching the rabbit hunting course?
Well, anytime. Maybe we should wait until January or so.
Okay. Sign us up.
Okay.
Sign us up.
That sounds great. Thank you for coming and talking with us today, Adam.
Oh, wait. We didn't get to taste the...
Wait.
Oh,
yeah. We have to taste some
the
things.
The best part
he's
is coming.
He's passing over... Two
so
dishes.
There's maitake with venison and just maitake.
Oh, this is the cooked maitake.
Yeah.
cooked my taco.
Oh, so what a nice texture.
Yeah, that all I did was cleaned it and then parboiled it for a little bit in a little bit of salt and then took it out and just stir-fried it in its own liquid for 5 to 10 minutes.
This has a lot more oomph than a Morel. I mean, it has Morels taste wonderful, but this has got body to it, body.
Yeah. Yeah, the maitake has a lot of flesh, so if you're familiar with a morel, you know it's hollow. So although they're very, very delicious,
so good.
There's not as much, you know, meat there, so to say. Mm-hmm. So when you find a maitake, you're really getting 5 to 10 pounds of awesomely delicious mushroom.
Oh, my goodness.
All right, so if I go looking for that in the woods and I see something that looks like that, It doesn't have anything else around that looks like that that would be inedible?
No,
So if it looks like that, I'm safe to pick it.
Yeah, basically. I mean, there are other varieties of mushrooms, like the turkey tail is a different polypore that has sort of similar colorings. But basically, if you find a mushroom that looks exactly like it at the base of an oak tree this time of year, you can be 99% sure that's true. But There's a lot of ways to check that. You can take a picture and, you know, ask people around town or post it on the internet to sort of get assurance. But yeah, that's another thing that's important to mention. It's very important to be 100% sure when you're going to be consuming wild edibles. But
I mean, this is so delicious. I want to run right out and I'm gobbling them up. I'm in the woods every day with the dogs. I could be picking
up mushrooms.
I'm sure
they're out there. Just the past couple days, it's been a very, very good year for them. You might find some that are sort of getting down there, but there's also some very fresh ones too. So yeah, there's
so
a lot
good.
Of very delicious food in the woods, and I think it's very beneficial to human health and the health of the ecological system that we reconnect with the value of this and appreciate its goodness.
Well put. Thank you for coming and talking to us, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
Good. We'll take a little break here.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI Radio 89.1. Serving Ames, Story City, and the surrounding areas. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You hear us Tuesdays at noon, repeated Tuesdays at 7 p.m. And check out Donna Lana Kitchen on the KHOIFM.org website. Most all the shows are archived now. You can find...
Oh, we're so on it.
What, we're on it. There's shows that are archived. There's some recipes there. There's a great picture of Donna and I. It's worth visiting the website. Also, remember, KHOI is streaming live. You don't have to be tied to a radio if you do not wish. Be tied to your computer instead.
Or if you don't have a radio anymore.
Be tied to your computer instead. So you've been listening to music by John Berquist and the Southside Swedes. It's October. Cool weather, first frost, trees are showing off their fall colors, and I'm thinking of Oktoberfest. Oktoberfest makes me think of accordions. John Berquist is a great accordion player. He plays all kinds of button accordions.
Accordions and beer.
Accordions and beer. John Berquist is a former Ames resident, actually. He lived here a long time ago, end of the last century, in the 90s sometime, yes. You may have remember him. He had these wonderful accordions. He's a musician, a storyteller, collector of songs and stories, and a cultural geographer, he calls himself. And that band that he recorded a whole bunch of Scandinavian music with is called the Southside Swedes, and it's a Chicago band. I don't know what he's doing now. I'm sure he's off making music and collecting folk stories. He lived for the longest time in way up in northern Minnesota, in the Iron Range, where the Finns, the Swedes, the Czechs all got up there. They mined and they got together and played music, and he collected a lot of that music. So Scandinavian music, Czech music. That last one we heard was called Slap Happy, a two-step that John wrote. And earlier in the show, you heard Lordag's Waltz, which was a Finnish waltz. Finnish, not done, but Finnish like the country. Yes, yes. So we were talking to Adam Wilkie about eating wild things. There's a lot of life around us, even if we live in an apartment or... we live in a city, we forget that the earth is just churning along underneath our feet. This is the time of year that you may be getting some visitors in your house. Mice are starting to move in, at least into my house. I live on the edge of the woods, so of course they see at my house is a very nice place to move into. So trapping, removing mice this time of year, it's just part of the landscape. And I was having trouble with chipmunks. Not in my house, but in my greenhouse. Chipmunks are lovely. They're really fun little things, but in your greenhouse, they love to dig things up, something fierce. And the traps that I had were not big enough for a chipmunk. They're a little hefty little guys. So I went online. Where do we find out anything? I found myself a chipmunk trap. So actually, this works really well on mice, too. So here's a quickie, non-toxic, you have it at home, chipmunk trap. Get yourself a 5-gallon bucket, fill it 3/4 full of water, prop a board from the ground up to the edge of this trap. You can see where this is going. Take a little bit of glue. Elmer's works fine. Put a few dots of glue along that little board. You're making a little plank for the little guys to walk. Put some sunflower seeds at the bottom of the plank. Glue a few little sunflower seeds up the plank. If you can balance some way at the top that's hanging over the edge of the water, do that. And sprinkle some sunflower seeds in the water because the sunflower seeds will float. Go away overnight. I guarantee something will find that. Find its way up the little plank and kerplop. You will have something. I do not wish to be morose here, but if you wish to get rid of chipmunks in your greenhouse, this does work. You can scoop the little guy out later.
I guess they don't swim.
They do, but I'm afraid they don't swim enough.
Oh, so okay.
If you want to catch them early and, like, drive them to the next county over, that's fine with me. But I have so many that I sort of It's all right. They just go the way of all the mice and chipmunks go the way of all flesh. There's just too many of them this time of year. So I encourage them to be out, and I stay in. So that's my quickie chipmunk trap.
I bet the chickens, your chickens would eat them.
They do. Actually, I throw them into the chickens. I didn't want to bring that up.
Let's get real here. Come on.
This is the noon hour, folks. I know you're sitting there with your lunch.
No, it's recycling. Come on.
Chickens eat anything. Chickens even like chicken. So think about that as you're eating your McChicken sandwich there. There you have it. All right. Oh, over the weekend, Donna, or was it last week?
It was last Friday.
Last Friday, you learned about something and had shared some dinner with something called the Food Corps. What's the Food Corps?
Right. Well, the Food Corps, and we're very lucky to have a lot of it in relative to the national politics. The Food Corps was begun, I'm guessing, maybe 5 years ago. There was a young man named Kurt Ells, who came to Iowa, and he made a film called King Corn, which was about corn growing in Iowa. It kind of toured around, was very well received. A lot of you may have seen it. Now, Kurt actually lives in New York. So when he got back to New York, having really made a tour of the Midwest and understood a lot more about food production or lack thereof, he founded an organization called the Food Corps. And basically, it's a nonprofit organization that has young people who have – it's kind of like a domestic Peace Corps for food workers, for people who want to improve the food system. So he started by raising quite a bit of money. It's a nonprofit. And then he – I think it's run through VISTA, although the VISTA volunteers the federal government contributes some, but mostly it's money that's been raised privately. So they have young people in their early 20s who go into schools and teach gardening, teach, get children to taste vegetables that they might not other. It was actually the organization was founded to combat childhood obesity. So a part of the issue with childhood obesity is kids are losing knowledge of their food. Does it grow in a garden? What grows in a garden? How do you grow a garden? Does a carrot really taste good? How about strawberries? What about green beans? So Kurt founded this organization called the Food Corps, and it's in, I think, about 15 states. I can't remember, but Iowa is one of them. And we have, this is sort of, the first year I believe there were only 50 nationally, and now they're up into the low hundreds or something. So this year's group of volunteers to Iowa, now they are paid a small, I don't know, $15,000 a year, but they have to live off of that. So they get a stipend to pay their rent and their food. And then they come and they volunteer mostly in schools. So we have them in Des Moines in the public schools. There's some in Blackhawk County, and there's some at Luther College working up there in the environmental studies. And then there's some in Cedar Rapids and some in Davenport, probably two or three kids. So we had a group of, I think, about 20 young people, and they're now spread out all over Iowa, but they were doing some kind of group orientation, and they were in Ames having a couple days together, and I know Fred Kirschman spoke to them. So then they wanted an all-local dinner. So I invited them to my house, and we had five courses, and we started with a lemon verbena shrub, and then we had some kernza bread with onion marmalade that Lana made.
Oh, yes.
And Prairie Breeze cheese. I thought, well, you can't come to Iowa and not know about Prairie Breeze cheese, which is from Kelowna. Lovely. That's our...
Remind us what the kernza is.
Oh, kernza bread is... Kernza is the flour that comes from the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, the perennial grain. So we had that with the Prairie Breeze cheese, which, of course, I love. And then the next course was I made a garlic panna cotta with Lana's garlic. So panna cotta is gelatin cream and garlic. This was a savory one. And then I covered it with a little basically tomato water. These were raw tomatoes in the blender. I put a little bit of vinegar in, and then I strained it so it was a clear liquid. So you had this pretty white custardy thing underneath with the and I added watermelon. So it was tomato watermelon. So prettiest pink color. That was the second course. The third course was Earl Hafner's corn porridge. So Earl has he has Early Morning Harvest, which is a mill in Panora, Iowa. And he called me a couple weeks ago, and he's gotten he went to make steel-cut oats. So he got a cutter, and then he decided he would cut his corn with it. So he sent it's really polenta, but it's a very large bit of it.
So it's a special mill. It has a certain...
Instead of grinding the corn, it cuts it, so it's larger chunks. So he calls it porridge, and it cooked up very nicely. I put also lots of cream in that. And I served that with, our fabulous meatloaf that we made, Lana and I made, that was organic pork and beef from the Roseman Farms and had about a third carrots in it. So it makes it really, really light and delightful. And we had that with a tomato gravy over it. And then for dessert, the dessert was the fun part. They wanted squash in the meal somewhere. So I hadn't put it – we're still a little early in the squash season. But I did get some buttercup squash, and I made buttercup squash ice cream. So I used pumpkin pie seasoning in it. So it was a delightful meal. And the Food Corps are a great group of kids, and they are really working in the public school systems to reduce childhood obesity and educate young children, actually high school too, I think, and also their parents are doing some teaching of cooking classes and growing gardens and things like that. And we're very lucky to have them in Iowa. So thank you to the Food Corps.
Sounds like a good project, and it sounds like you fed them well.
Oh, we had a good time.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's good. I have a little bit of a chicken update here, just to let you know what's going on in the hen house. My rooster, big white leghorn, lost all of its tail feathers. So this poor guy looks very front heavy. Right now, he's getting them back, but that happens.
I bet he's not strutting his stuff so proudly.
He doesn't strut. He's kind of slinking right now. To let you know, chickens do lose their feathers. Molting is part of it. Chickens aren't always good looking. They sometimes have bad hair days, and this was one of them. So there you go. So we'll hope for feathers to come back.
Yeah,
soon.
Before the cold weather. Otherwise, he's going to freeze his tail.
Well, he'll be fine. He'll be fine. I have a poem here. We're celebrating language. This poem is by a poet named Sharon Bryan. The poem is called Sweater Weather, a love song to language. Never better, mad as a hatter. Right as rain, might and main, hanky-panky, hot toddy, hoity-toity, cold shoulder, bowled over, rolled in clover, low blow, no soap, hope against hope, pay the piper, liar, liar, pants on fire, high and dry, shoe fly pie, fiddle faddle, fit as a fiddle, salt in the swat, muskrat ramble, fat and sassy, flim flam, happy as a clam. Cat's pajamas, bee's knees, peas in a pod, pleased as punch. Pretty as a picture, nothing much. Lift the latch, double dutch, helter-skelter, hurdy-gurdy. Early bird, feathered friend. Dumb cluck, buck up. Shilly-shally, willy-nilly, roly-poly, holy-moly. Loose lips, sink ships. Spitting image, nip in the air. Hail and hearty, part and parcel, upsy-daisy, lazy days, maybe baby. Up to snuff, flibberty gibbet, honky tonk, spick and span, handyman, cool as a cucumber, blue moon, high as a kite, night and noon, love me or leave me, seventh heaven, up and about, over and out.
And we all know what those mean.
All of them. You've run across things like that every now and then. That's good. We've got some stuff coming up in the Ames area. One of them is a chili cook-off. It's time to think chili. And the Ames Main Street Farmers Market will be having a chili cook-off. I think this is their first annual. Everybody's got their own idea of how chili should be made. They're having their first annual chili cook-off at the Ames Main Street Farmers Market on October 18th. And the deadline for registration is October 16th. The chili cook-off is open to the public, and you can get applications and more information at AmesMainStreetFarmersMarket.com. You can contact Lo Jean Peterson. She's the market master there. And you can download a form, find all sorts of information at that website that I
so
just gave.
So this is sort of a morning luncheon chili meal.
Oh, luncheon. A chili brunch, I believe.
Chili for breakfast.
People will bring their best. There will be a judge's choice winner and a people's choice winner. So look into that if you want to stretch your stuff at the Ames Farmers Market on October 18th. We've got the World Food Prize. The World Food Prize is in Des Moines next week, and there's also something called the Occupy the World Food Prize. Two things going on all at once.
One being the alternative to the very public, well-known food prize.
Right. So look into both of those, worldfoodprize.org, and you can also find more information, occupytheworldfoodprize.com. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with Lana Nachtigal
and Donna Prisgintas, eating venison miyatake mushrooms right now.
We had our special guest, Adam Wilkie, talked about wild edibles. Yum.
And brought some in to taste.
Excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. We'd like to hear from you. What's on your plate? Contact us at khoiradio@gmail.com. Support your local radio station. Listen, contribute to community radio. Eat good food and enjoy life. Thank you.